Good morning. Garth Hewitt from Amos Trust, and I'm impressed on the Monday morning of Greenbelt that you're here looking sharp and alert. I'm not feeling quite that way, but I'm here. And at Amos, we had been negotiating with Greenbelt for a long time that we wanted to have Mark, and so it's been very special to have him here. And I'm sure most of you have heard Mark during the course of the weekend. If this is your first time to hear Mark Ellis, then do take the opportunity afterwards. He's going to do some signing down at the bookstore, and his Theology of Jewish Liberation is one of the books there. He has a new book down there as well, and his books are immensely worth picking up and following on from what he's been doing today. We've had a tremendous insight from Mark, and I think he's challenged us and opened us up to all sorts of different possibilities and ways forward, and we're committed to walking with him into exile, I think, and we do it together, and it's been very encouraging. But this morning, an extremely important one on the theme of Israel and Palestine, and the title that he's given to this morning's one is Israel Different? So will you welcome, a special welcome, I think, because it's his last one, will you welcome Mark Ellis?
Thank you very much, Garth, for that warm introduction. And I'm very glad to be back at the race course with the music. This venue is quite different. So that leads us into the topic for the day. Is Israel different? And I want to break this question, is Israel different, into at least two parts to begin with. And the first part is the people Israel different? The second part, the state of Israel. Because looking at the two parts helps us to connect the people Israel and the state of Israel, and also may point out some of the disconnects. And then the question is, what do we do with the connection and the disconnection? So, first, the people Israel. And of course, I speak as a Jew, and I won't be politically correct today. I'm going to let out all my biases and just share them with you, knowing that you don't have to assent to them at all, but this is how I will speak about it today. I have always felt that being Jewish is different and special. And I think there is a difference about the people Israel, or there should be, and this is how I would define it. I believe, through the Hebrew Bible, and through my own experience, that the people Israel is different. That is, from the beginning, we have felt ourselves to be different. If you look at the narrative in the Hebrew Bible itself, a nothing of a people, slaves, all of them, are featured as the center of history. And the people Israel have always felt that they are the center of history. Now again, no one needs to assent to this. It is an absurd and ridiculous and unbelievable claim which Jews hold, and which I hold. That there is something about being Jewish that is at the center of the world. Well, what is that something? Well, the covenant given by God at Sinai and embraced, also, of course, betrayed. The prophetic, that which is indigenous to Israel, that which we gave to the world, our greatest gift to the world, the prophetic. Now, when I say it's our greatest gift, it doesn't mean that the people Israel have followed the prophetic. from the beginning, all of these issues and themes that I'm speaking about have been contested, have been betrayed, have been returned to, have been hoped for, have been exiled from. So we have this sense of specialness, of chosenness, of the prophetic, which is at the heart of what it means to be Jewish, which is often not lived out by Jews. So the people Israel, yes, there is a difference. Maybe all peoples have a difference. I'm speaking simply here of my people. Well, if you look at the journey of the people Israel through time, you see many things. Suffering, struggle, contribution, giving to the world, taking from the world, a long history of suffering, struggle, and contribution, which was often unrewarded in the world and often penalized in the world. And we have to ask, why the penalty for being this distinctive people? Well, it may be that other peoples felt that they were the center of the world and resented this claim to be central. It could be that the center of what it means to be the people Israel was so challenging, not only to Israel, but to others, that the desire was to extinguish this challenge because it was too demanding. And one of the great, now British, literary critics, George Steiner, analyzed it this way in terms of anti-Semitism, that the peoples of the world resented Jews because of the challenge that Jews gave to the world, at least the prophetic. It was too demanding. Well, a lot of Jewish history has been suffering, especially in Europe, leading up to the Holocaust, untold suffering in our time. My father served in World War II, very close to me. He's still alive. And thus the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. So we have the people Israel, its journey in its diversity over time. And then recently, culminating in the Holocaust and the birth of the State of Israel, and certainly one can understand that birth and even applaud its birth, a small part of the world, an ancient homeland for the people Israel who were dispersed in suffering. Who could argue with that? I certainly don't argue with that. Unfortunately, where that state was built for the people Israel, others were living, Palestinians. And the creation of a Jewish state necessarily meant the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. That was in the creation. And then since then, with the expansion of Israel over time, 1967 and after, there has been further dispossession of Palestinians. And when I travel tonight to Israel and Palestine, to Bethlehem, perhaps the culmination of this expansion is that I will be visiting a walled-in city where Palestinians are not free to travel out of. So the question for Jews now, is Israel the state different like Israel the people? The idea of the State of Israel was to take this different people, give it a homeland again, where it could reestablish its difference for good in the world. And though Israel has done many good things, it will be known primarily for the dispossession of another people. Now that's sealed. More or less, that's over. Israel has conquered the Palestinians. It controls from Tel Aviv to the Jordan River, and in my lifetime and perhaps beyond, it will continue to do that. There are millions of Palestinians within that expanded state, over a million within the state of Israel, and millions in the West Bank, and then we have Gaza as well. So we have one land controlled by one power with millions of Palestinians who live uneasily at best within that state. So here now is the question. Is Israel, the people established in the state, different? Or do we do what others have done to us, what others have done to others, when we have the power to do it? And the answer has to be now, yes. This special people, Israel, in a very interesting special state, does everything done to us and does everything that others have done. And there may be no way back to this specialness. Now, within Zionism, this movement of Jews to the land, this ancient homeland, and the establishment of the state, there were Jews who wrote and fought for a homeland in Palestine where Jews and Arabs would live together in Palestine. And such Jewish luminaries as Martin Buber, Judah Magnus, and Hannah Arendt spoke and wrote in the 1930s and 40s and beyond for that solution to the need of Jews and the need of Arabs in a unified Palestine to have homelands. Now, of course, that lost. But that was an attempt by Buber and Magnus and Hannah Arendt to reassert this difference of the people Israel in the situation of history in the Holy Land. Could we begin today to re-explore that sense of homeland rather than state, living together rather than power over? And would that again bring forth this specialness out of this quagmire that we as Jews have built for ourselves? So that's one thought that I have that I want to leave you with, this homeland vision. But the other thought is what I call Jews of conscience. The Constantinian Jewish establishment in America, in Britain, in Israel, has had its way, established a state, enabled the state, supported the state, expanded that state, conquered another people, they've won. In this way, they are like any other people and any other religion, any other Constantinian establishment like Constantinian Christianity and Constantinian Islam. But there are Jews of conscience who have refused this Constantinianism. Are they reasserting in their own journey the specialness, the difference of the people Israel now that we have a state of Israel? Now, these Jews of conscience, very interesting, are in exile, another theme in Jewish history. And most, if not all of them, are completely secular. Are they carrying the covenant with them into exile? Are they carrying the prophetic with them into exile? Are they the remnant of the people Israel? Are they the last exile in Jewish history? Because there may be no way back. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, we have this sensibility, this rhythm of entry into the land, expulsion from the land, return. But Israel has now returned to the land, and now there's a new exile. If Jews of conscience are to return, what will that mean? And who will they return or turn to? Could these Jews of conscience, with Palestinians of conscience, and people all over the world of conscience, turn to another way of being political, being social, being cultural, be religious, and create a new kind of homeland movement in the Holy Land, or what I like to call the unholy land, which might become, again, a witness to the world, like the people Israel were in its origins. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you for just carrying on despite... Yes, it's an unseemly hour to have that music, but there we are. I don't know that we know how to stop it, so thank you for concentrating. Thank you again. And this one, I'm sure, come and... the microphone is here. Come and ask your questions. And particularly, Mark, picking up there on a vision of Jews of conscience re-establishing something very special in exile. And come on up and form a queue. It doesn't have to even be an orderly queue. Come and form a queue here and ask some of the questions. Yes, I see movement. Running to ask a question. That's impressive. Thank you.
And politically, your vision seems pretty, hopeful. I mean, it looks pretty unhopeful that you ever get to that stage. I mean, wouldn't a transition stage be to encourage the Palestinians and the Israelis to form one state eventually? Because all these small bits and pieces that are occupied by different groups, it just seems impossible. Even a two-state solution seems impossible. So wouldn't the sort of more secular version of one enlarged state be a more pragmatic way of coming back from exile?
Well, I've tried to explain to people who criticize my radical thinking that I have always been a moderate politically on Israel and Palestine. That is, I've been supportive of a two-state solution. Because when you have radical thoughts, you also have to think of the people who have to live them. And so I want the reestablishment or the establishment of ordinary life for Jews and Palestinians in two states, which may lead to something else at another time. But you're quite right in saying, I think, that that two-state solution, that moderate solution, which I hold, has been foreclosed by the expansion of Israel. And that there are only bits and pieces of Palestine left, not enough in any way to form a real viable state. So the question we're faced with now is not my ideals or your ideals or what we want or don't want. We're faced with a reality that is, which doesn't allow a two-state solution. To have two real states, you'd have to have a complete withdrawal of Israel to the 67 borders, which nobody in the world thinks will happen. And so any state that emerges in Palestine will be a state that is not a state, the most unusual non-state, with all the demands that are made upon it, including being demilitarized, which I'd love all states to be, but you can't ask one when everybody else is armed to the teeth. And even this latest proposal, which has been floating around for a decade or more, of a tunnel to Gaza, which will be controlled by Israel. And all the electricity, for instance, that goes into Gaza is controlled by Israel. All of this is controlled by Israel, even if there was a kind of a rump state. So my own sense is whatever is happening politically and whatever is being floated, in fact, we have one state. And Jews of conscience, of which there are many in Israel, and Palestinians of conscience, have to come together in a civil rights struggle over the next 50 or 100 years. If something catastrophic doesn't happen in the meantime. Because with all the warfare and all the killing and all the destruction, which has been horrible beyond belief, the catastrophic, which could happen, hasn't. Coming from either side in different ways, right? So we need to be moderate so that people can live. But we're in a situation which is unlivable.
Thank you very much. My question actually was very much like the first question's one. But maybe if you could expand a little bit, because I know within the Palestinian community, certainly there is a recognition now that the two-state solution is basically dead in its current form because of the facts on the ground, as you've explained them. Could you maybe say a little bit more about what the vision, not necessarily just within the Jews of conscience, but more within the Israeli state and within the broader Jewish diaspora is towards a one-state solution? Because what it always seems from the outside is that the only way in which that is envisaged within Israel is a one-state solution with further expulsion of the Palestinians. So if you could shed some light on whether there are other sort of models which may be there.
Well, there have been some Jewish intellectuals who have come out for the one state because of the situation, but they have been roundly criticized by the Jewish establishment and demonized. And the fear is, the stated fear, is that would be the end of Jewish life in the land. But that's what we have, one state. So this holding ground against the one state is really enabling the oppression to continue. Now, by the way, it's not just Jews. I mean, we had an ecumenical dialogue here yesterday where we had a very prominent professor who's a member of the ecumenical deal, Christian. So Christians have helped enable this oppression by continuing to speak to Jews in a very patronizing way and not telling the truth. And the Jewish establishment doesn't want the truth. And so we have a lot of untruth. How we're going to move toward the truth of the matter, the facts on the ground, and then to think about what can be done, well, there's so much power against that kind of thinking. And also the Palestinian establishment continues to talk about two states, even though they can't, in my own view, really believe it. I was there just a year ago and talking to a Palestinian who said that it would be best if the Palestinian Authority just collapsed, that they had no government. And now the Palestinian Authority is heavily indebted to American money, although it's little, and American military. We have Tony Blair now traveling. What did he do for Palestine or Palestinians while he was prime minister? So we have almost like a conspiracy against recognizing what the truth is. Now, Tony Blair is an intelligent man. President Clinton is an intelligent man. You would think that they can see what all of us can see. So why don't they say it? Why is there this inability to state the truth? Yesterday, again, in this ecumenical deal dialogue, our person, professor, said that the Palestinian question was a local question, that Jews in England had to deal with what was happening in Bradford, and Jews in Los Angeles had to deal with what was happening in Los Angeles. There's nobody in the world that thinks the Palestinian question is a local question. Except Israel, who would love it to be local so they could take care of business. So I'd love to tell you that I know how to move there. It's not going to move there in my lifetime. There's going to be more suffering. The situation is going to get worse. And I have been saying this for over a decade. And unfortunately, I've been right.
Last November, I was in Israel, and our guide basically said, pointed at the wall and said, you know, this is something that none of us want, but we just see it as a necessary evil because of those who wish to murder us. And to what extent is what has happened over the last 60 years a reaction to those who have basically wanted to allow no quarter for the Jews in the land at all and basically to destroy them? So to what extent has it been a case of self-defense rather than oppression?
Well, when you plant a state and dispossess a people, you probably shouldn't expect the dispossessed people to send you love notes. Now, this is what's amazing me in the Jewish psyche. Often, we want those whom we dispossessed to not only affirm our right to dispossess them, but that they love us. Now, this is part of the specialness of the Jewish people, which is really interesting, but which we have to confront. When you dispossess a people, those people will try to regain what they lost. And of course, they have a right to try to regain it. So the opposition to Israel by the Arab governments, as we often say, is not something that's simply an anti-Jewish, we don't want Jews to have a safe place or any place, but the fact that it was created in their part of the world with a massive dispossession, which continues. You see, this is my point. One could argue from a Jewish perspective that a Jewish state was needed. We can argue that. And that in the world, every nation state that has come into being has come into being through violence. Okay. But when we continue on, say that was an emergency situation after the Holocaust. It doesn't mean a Palestinian has to say yes to that, but let's just say from a certain Jewish perspective, understandable, regrettable, understandable. Well, when the emergency's over, you begin to rectify that wrong. But we haven't. And most often, we blame it on the other, which is what every people does. Now, the Jewish prophetic in this case says, don't point your finger outward, point it inward. And of course, that's what the prophets did in the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible has the prophetic at the center, pointing itself at Israel, the people. And since we have power in Israel over against others, it is our responsibility to rectify the situation. If we begin to rectify it, we can also demand a security to continue to live there as we pursue justice. As I said, I'm a moderate. But we can't expect people to love us while we dispossess and continue to further that dispossession.
Mark, thank you very much, Mark. I think I'm trying to travel with the people of Israel and Palestine on this long journey. And what you said this morning makes me think that it's an even longer journey than I'd previously imagined. So can you say perhaps how do we start or how do we continue on that journey? And who are the guides at the moment about that journey and taking us to the 50 years or more that you were talking about?
Well, first of all, we have to stop listening to people who say it takes a long time, even though it will. And we have to stop listening to those who say we have to deal with local politics, even though we do. We have to end the ecumenical deal, and we have to speak truth to power, as we do in other situations. And truth has to be spoken to Israel and Jews, just as it needs to be spoken in other parts of the world. We also have to give up the slogans we've had, two states for two peoples, and all of these slogans that make really good bumper stickers and nice pins, because they're finished, it's over. And I've been talking about this for years and have been banned from certain groups for doing so, because they feel that if we say the journey is too long and uncertain, who's going to sign up for it? Who wants that kind of journey? So many of the groups that have been in the forefront of the struggle for a just peace between Israel and Palestine are part of the problem, because they are telling us things to mobilize us that are not going to come true and are so distant that they become lies. So we don't need to look for guides. We need to look at the facts on the ground. When we look at the facts on the ground and learn about them, then we will know what can be done within those facts to begin to move those facts to a different way over time. But the idea that these slogans will continue to be effective when they haven't been effective is an illusion. So let's end our illusion about what's going to happen there, see what is happening, and ask ourselves, what can we do within what is happening, and what kind of vision can we have that comes out of what is happening? Some people say, well, that's a very despairing point of view. Well, where does hope come from? From moving away from reality, moving our face away, or from confronting it? If you're terminally ill, you have 3 days to say you're not. Then you better deal with the fact that you are. Israel-Palestine is terminally ill. We better deal with that fact.
Mark, thank you for everything you've said so far. There are some things, perhaps are a matter of interpretation of what's happened in the past, that I would take issue with, particularly the economic benefits to Palestine in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that drew many people from nations around into the land, non-Jewish people, who became part of that conglomerate of people who were caught up in those issues around 1947, 1948.
Oh, wait a minute. So what?
And
wait a minute.
Well,
an
issue I have then is, you said that the creation of the state necessarily meant the expulsion of Palestinians.
A Jewish state, yes.
Of a Jewish state.
Yeah.
And yet many people were drawn in to and benefited from
do we have to go through South Africa?
Okay, all right.
Excuse me.
I'm
responding for a minute.
Okay.
Do we have to go back to South Africa, where the white South Africans were talking about the benefits of their economy for blacks in South Africa? Do we really want to go back to that argument? And when a South African black said to me, you're a slave whether you're well-fed or not, in that system? Do we really want to go back there? People have migrated forever. In fact, Jews migrated there, partially for economic benefits. Should we then say that Palestinians have a right to throw them into the sea? Please, let's not go back there. People who are living wherever they're living have a right to live there and to flourish. When a people comes from outside, which the Jews of Europe did, by the way, not Jewish Palestinians, because they lived there, and they often were dispossessed in the creation of the State of Israel. So let's not go back to that. It's a very apartheid sensibility. Next.
Okay. The question I've got really is how much you would see or take on board the perhaps the more theological view of the Jewish people saying we will have a king like the other nations around us.
Well, that was a big argument in the Hebrew Bible, because when there was the proposal to have a king, a human king, God is reported to have said, I don't know whether God said this, you know, but is reported to have said, hey, are you crazy? This is part of the stand-up Jewish comedy. This is where Jewish comedy comes from. Are you nuts? You crazy? Because if you appoint a king, you know what they're going to do? They're going to build an empire. And if they build an empire, they're going to have a big army. And if they have a big army and they build an empire, they're going to want really nice palaces and temples. And you know who's going to build them? Most of the Israelites. So you ought to think twice, God said, reportedly, about having a king. Big argument. And God relents, says, okay, take it. You want it, take it, you'll pay up. But they used to call Ariel Sharon the king of Israel. Now, let's think about that. I'm sorry. We're in a land where you have kings and queens. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'll back off.
No, say what you were going to say. Got some Republicans here.
Do continue.
I think you get the point. I'm not against every king and queen that's ever been there. I just don't want a king of Israel. You want to have a king here or a queen, you take it.
I think the point I'm trying to make is that of being like the other nations, of taking the
right
forms of authority and state, as you talk about.
Well, the prophetic
like
says
the
no
nations,
to that.
Rather than having God, Yahweh, as...
Well,
I think
it's best authority now if we have a secular government. We'll leave God out of the governance for now. I mean, God has been absent a lot in our history lately, so I don't want him coming back as a king. But I think there's something called democracy, which is very complex, but which we ought to try to work out. And we have worked out to some extent among Jews in Israel. Maybe we ought to have a democracy where Palestinians are included too. And then we could get to a democratic form of government, sharing the power and all. And then if we want to have a titular king or queen, like you now have here, that can own a lot of land and can raise the flag when they're there or not, then so be it.
Okay, we'll take the last three questioners who are here, and if you could keep your questions brief, that would be helpful, because I know people want to move on to other places for 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you for your vision of the remnant being the Jews of conscience. Where do the Orthodox Jews and the fanatical Jews fit in to this picture? Can you have a conversation with them at all?
Well, Orthodox Jews aren't necessarily fanatical. They could just be Orthodox, and there is an Orthodox Jew that I know quite well who's just written a book on the question of Zionism in the Jewish tradition. And he's quite critical of Zionism, maybe even more critical than I am. So we shouldn't judge a person by the clothes they wear or the prayers they say. I certainly do not judge a Christian by the prayers they say. I let them say the prayers, and then I say, okay, what are you doing? Well, we ought to do that with Jews too. It's what people do, not their spiritual practice. So Orthodox Jews are not necessarily fanatical. Some secular Jews can be fanatical. It's a combination. You have people from different strands of Jewish life who act as people of conscience, who act as Constantinian Jews, and most Jews are in between. In fact, Joseph Lieberman spoke to an evangelical group in the United States recently, and said something very interesting. He said there are more Christian Zionists today than Jewish Zionists. And he may be right, because a lot of Jews are disenchanted with what's happened. They don't know what to do. They don't know the way forward, and some of them are afraid to speak out. But I wouldn't judge any Jew or any person by what they wear or what they believe or what they say they believe. I'd rather judge them by what they do.
I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit, please, about the relationship between Jew and Israeli, and also whether you are saying, and it may be the same question, that if the state of Israel is terminally ill, does that mean the future of Judaism is almost necessarily to be happy in exile?
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I didn't say that Israel is terminally ill. I said the situation there is terminally ill. Happy in exile don't go together. But I did write this book some time ago titled Practicing Exile. And the question there is, how does a Jew survive in exile? What kind of practice do we need? The question of Jew and Israeli is very interesting, because there are more than a few Israelis who do not consider themselves Jews. That is, Jewish Israelis who don't. And they see themselves as a nationality. And so there's a division there. And I think we ought to take that division seriously, because if the people Israel is the center of what it means to be Jewish, then the state is peripheral, which doesn't mean it's always necessarily bad. But there is an underlying Jewishness that has to be recovered, and that, I think, is being recovered by Jews of conscience. But the whole community is so set in a certain pattern that that remnant may never reconnect with other Jews. I don't know that. I'm just saying it's possible that this is the last exile in Jewish history. And what will happen, is already happening, is that these Jews of conscience are coming into community with others of conscience, Christians of conscience, Muslims of conscience, secular folks of conscience, and they are in what I call the new diaspora. And a new community is forming there. Will the particularity of Jewishness in that new community end? I don't know. I won't see that time. I can only see that exile land.
Largely, you've almost covered what I was going to ask, actually. I note that you said earlier that the majority of the Jews with conscience that you mentioned are secular. And so my question really was that, in terms of this new diaspora that you were talking about yesterday in particular, is it possible to maintain a religious distinctiveness whilst living in that kind of thing, or is religion going to wane from that?
Well, we've had this question about Jewish distinctiveness from the beginning as well. Already in the Hebrew Bible, they're worrying about assimilation. And what's interesting is, through all of this, Jewish distinctiveness has endured. It has taken somewhat different forms. Why has it endured? There are all sorts of speculations about it. My own sense is, and I can't, this is not biology, I can't prove it, is that something happened in the giving of the covenant that has never left the Jewish people and will never leave. And so I believe, this is heretical, don't quote me, and please turn off the tape. I do think there's somewhat like a genetic inheritance of being Jewish. And that, and I'm so, and maybe this is where we'll end here. I thought for some time that with my generation, the Jewish prophetic would come to an end. And then my son, Aaron, at the age of 14, wrote a letter to the Israeli Council of Houston, who had spoken at my university. And I read that letter all over the world. Now, okay, he is my son, all right. But forgetting about that for a minute, it was a prophetic announcement. That's when I knew that the Jewish prophetic would never die.
Thank you very much, Mark. I think that is exactly the right point to finish. The reminder, we've found the challenge to be the prophetic, to be voices of conscience, and I think the challenge there also for Christians to remember to not let our voice of prophecy die. The ecumenical deal silences so many Christians, and Mark has challenged that and called us to recognize where things are terminally ill, but then to walk forward in this exile with prophetic voices and to link arms together, Jew, Christian, Muslim, secular, and so on. I think it's a tremendous vision. It leaves us with a lot of hope. But also, just listening to Mark has opened us up to so many different aspects of prophecy, of spirituality, of also a vision of Jewishness. There's so many things there. So once again, thank you very much, Mark. He's heads off to Bethlehem tonight, or today, Tel Aviv, and then Bethlehem. We're delighted to have had you with us. Let's show our appreciation, Mark Ellis.